Blog Talk Radio.
Blessed souls, good morning. This is the Generation Redemption from Yitzhak Paton, Isaac Paton's wonderful CD, Generation Redemption. And we're live because we want to be staying alive in Torah Chaim, instructions of life, Torah Chesed, instructions of kindness, Torah Rachim, instructions of mercies. You're tuned into the higher inner frequency of blogtalkradio.com at Soul Class 461. Secular by Design, Part 34. Blesses our Creator. Bracha, blessing, and shalom, peace upon the human family experience. With Hashem's help, right now we're broadcasting at 9:33 Eastern Standard Time, live from Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA. Unifying souls, actually. Program content will focus on reading from Alan W. Cecil's seminal work, Secular by Design, A Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances. And we're going to just turn down the music of Rabbi Isaac Paton so we can get on with the shoe. Sorry, Rabbi Isaac. Oh, there we go. Bye-bye music. But let's get back into the show. And joining us today, we have Rambam, student, teacher, and activist for the dissemination of the teachings of Rambam, Moshe Ben Maimon Maimonides, Nesher Gadol, the great eagle, Dennis Ryan. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning, Don.
Good morning, Dennis. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the fact today, Dennis, and for those of you listening out there, and by the way, we are live, and you can call in and listen live at 347-838-8669, or in the future you can hear the archive version. I would be remiss if I didn't mention today is a very special day on the Hebrew calendar day. It happens to be today, the 11th day of the Hebrew month of Nisan, 4 days away from the celebration for the 3,327th time, of the festival of Matzah, Passover. Today, however, happens to be that 113 years ago, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, was born. So I'm going to pluck out a teaching that the Rebbe gleaned out from his father-in-law as a preface to today's program, because we're getting some pretty heavy matters here, plucking out from Allen's book, again, Secular by Design, A Philosophy of No Head Laws and Observances, because the Rebbe was a human being who was solely dedicated to helping human beings try to rectify matters in this world, to improve this world, and I'm sure certainly he would have approved of such a book that we are sharing on a weekly basis. Anyway, this happens to be a teaching from a seminar work called Hayom Yom, and it reads like this: on a person's birthday, one should spend time in seclusion. He or she should recall his or her experiences and think deeply into them. A person, he or she, should then hopefully make the wise decision to get close to the Creator, what the world will call repentance, and correct those of his past deeds that need correction and repentance. And that is the spirit of why we're presenting this material, blessed souls, to realize that in the name of humanism and modern secular philosophy, which was basically a subterfuge for attacking biblical teachings written in all Torah traditions, that we see that the replacement theology, the replacement psychology, or the replacement philosophy actually led to even more heinous events than which they had accused had been portrayed in the Bible. So we're going right now into the section of Allen's book called The Dark Side of Enlightenment, and we're picking back up from last week when we were talking about John Stuart Mill, who was considered to be a British intellectual who lived from 1806 to 1873, and he was very open about his being anti-Bible, anti-Old Testament, and also critical of the New Testament. But yet, he himself had both of his hands, emotionally and intellectually, allegorically speaking, as a promoter of the suffering of the Irish people over in Europe in the mid-19th century. And we can go right into the page 69 of Secular by Design, Protocols of a Philosopher, The Dark Side of the Enlightenment. So here we go. And then, we'll, of course, we'll be turning to Dennis for comments, questions, and concerns about this matter. So we go back, blessed souls, as Allen did, to the summer of 1845. Just as the potato crop was about to be harvested, a blight that had wiped out potato crops in both America and Europe struck Ireland. The effects were devastating, and entire fields were destroyed overnight. This blight would affect the potato crop for the next 3 years, and during that time, nearly 1 million people died of starvation or disease. What made this disaster so disturbing was that there was, in fact, at that same time, a tremendous amount of food being produced in Ireland. And while the Irish were literally dropping dead in the streets from starvation, ships loaded with Irish grain and cattle were constantly being sent across the water to England. During the famine, the British Parliament refused to repeal the Corn Laws, which put a high tariff on foreign grain in order to ease the suffering of the Irish people. Meaning, if the Corn Law had been repealed, the Irish people would have had it better. So let's go a little bit deeper into that based on footnote 20 from Allen's book on page 70. And we're quoting now from Woodman Smith's The Great Hunger in Ireland from 1845-1849, page 50. The purpose of the Corn Laws was to keep up the price of homegrown grain duties on imported grain, guaranteed English farmers a minimum and profitable price, and the burden of higher price for bread was borne by the laboring classes, in particularly the millions of factory workers and operatives toiling in the great new industrial cities. That's, of course, in England. It was asserted that if the Corn Laws were repealed, all classes connected with the land would be ruined and the traditional social structure of the country destroyed, and all interest in Ireland was submerged by virtue of these Corn Laws, spelled like the, you know, like the vegetable corn. Now, this was due to the popularity, the failure to repeal the Corn Laws, as Allen asserts. This was due to the popularity of the concept of laissez-faire, of letting the economy run without government interference, a philosophy John Stuart Mill supported. The irony of this was that the government policies themselves, laws protecting the British landlords and keeping the prices of foreign grain artificially high, then added to the grinding misery of the Irish. Dennis, what do we make of this? I mean, for that period where there was the suffering in Ireland, the British people, the Parliament, and intellectuals like John Mill just turned their backs on it in the name of what? Humanism? Philosophy?
No, in the name of government. So what happens is, this is how polite society committed genocide. And what they did was, they wanted to get rid of the Irish because they were multiplying like rabbits all over the place, and it was considered a burden to the English government. So the English government quite politely said, we'll just cut off all their access to food, and let's see what happens. Because they understood, if there's no food, well, people are going to get very hungry or die, whatever the case may be. So they did this in a very humanistic way by saying they were following the economic forces. So they came up with all this nonsense to get rid of the Irish people. And it was quite successful, because even when you hear a million people here or there, you got to remember there wasn't facts and figures recorded here. So the English, the source was from English, they understated everything. So it made it sound very polite, humanistic, and meanwhile, the genocide is going on. So people had no choice. Either you go hungry and die, or you go someplace else. Well, since in those days, they didn't let them into England, they found out other polite ways to keep them away. Then they migrated to the United States in droves and droves and droves. But the English wanted to minimize everything and say, well, this is just a simple economic problem. Nice if you can get away with it.
But so then it's just saying in reporting it, if whatever media, I mean, I'm sure there were newspapers back then in the mid-19th century, you're saying they undercut the number of casualties or deaths. It's hard, you know, I understand that people can turn a cold shoulder if a tragedy of this magnitude in those 3, 4, 5 years took place, if it's on the other side of the world. But, I mean, we're talking about one landmass to another, which was probably, I mean, how far is England from Ireland? 20 miles by sea to 15 miles, 10 miles? I mean, it's with such proximity, certainly must have been people making it into the island of England to say there's a disaster going on.
They didn't allow for anybody to object. They didn't allow, didn't have any forum. And the government controlled most of the newspapers in those days. You got to remember that communications is not the same level today. Today, if something like this is going on, someone always has a little camera or they have a little hand device that's recording these things. In those days, even when you got a newspaper, you were getting a week's old update. So you were reading not the newspapers of what happened last night or yesterday, but several days prior to that. So if you wanted to keep this quiet, minimize it, understate everything, then it looks like there's no emergency. And you think they were really counting the people that died? No way. They just came out and said, oh, this is terrible, a terrible economic condition. No, it was sponsored by the government, enforced by the government, and made sure what the final result was. So even though these people said they were humanistic, they were committing genocide.
Sure. Were the poor masses of Ireland, were they buried in mass graves, or were they at least given the dignity of individual burial sites?
We don't even know those facts because most of the Irish were so poor they couldn't afford anything. So when the English government decided to do this, that, and the other thing for hygienic reasons or even economic reasons, the human statistics became unrecognizable. Mm-hmm. Why? Because the government was doing what the government does and they were taking care of the English citizens at the expense of the Irish poor. So the poor doesn't have newspapers that are printing about poor ideas, and England controlled everything. So what they did was they transferred it into as a government action to keep the world healthy, so to speak. But they considered the Irish as an age-old vermin problem that they have to get rid of and solve the situation. So when people make up their mind for humanism, they look the other way and they come up with these rationalizations that seem so nice because there's no face to it and there's no fingerprints. There's nobody checking on anything. It's the government was issuing information and that was it.
Right. Going further, thank you, Dennis. Going further on, as Alan illustrates the role that John Stuart Mill had in this heinous occurrence in the mid-19th century, going on page 70, Mill, siding with the British ruling class, and here Alan quoted from Edward E.D. Steele's J.S. Mill and the Irish Question, The Principles of Political Economy, 1848 to 1865, which was published in the Historical Journal, Volume 13, Number 2, in June 1970, page 117. And here Alan quoted from Steele. Mill exerted a considerable influence on the educated. The effects of his teaching provided confirmation of the economic reasons usually put forward against the claims of the Irish peasantry. So going back into the book itself, prior to this footnote that I read from footnote 21, Mill, siding with the British ruling class, seemed to think that the Irish had every right to execute their personal freedom to starve to death, but not to cause harm to others, meaning the Irish landlords or the grain and beef merchants in England who were selling Irish-grown crops to the poorly paid and overworked laborers who toiled in the textile mills of Britain. In the classic way of quote-unquote blaming the victim, the English criticized the Irish for living like animals and foolishly depending on the potato when it was practically the only crop the Irish could feed themselves with on their miserably small leftover scraps of land allotted to them by their British overlords. This attitude of blaming the victim, which is similar to how the Jews were often blamed for their problems, such as being moneylenders when other forms of businesses were forbidden to them, is summed up by the Charles Edward Trevelyan, the head of the Treasury of England, who so poetically commented that, quote, the great evil which we have to contend is not the physical evil of the famine, but the moral evil of the selfish, perverse, and turbulent character of the Irish people, and that's quoting again from Woodham Smith's The Great Hunger, page 156. John Stuart Mill's own view of the Irish disaster was that, quote-unquote, in any continental complications, the sympathies of England would be with liberalism, while those of Ireland would sure to be on the same side as the Pope, that is, on the side opposed to modern civilization and progress, and to the freedom of all except Catholic populations held in subjection by non-Catholic rulers. And that's quoting from Bruce L. Kinzer's England's Disgrace, J.S. Mill and the Irish Question, printed by Toronto, University of Toronto Press, 2001, pages 169 to 170. Because the Irish were white, they got off relatively easy. Other countries the British conquered, either militarily or economically, were not so lucky, especially if the indigenous population was made of brown people. The indigenous populations of India, China, and the Australian Aborigines, to give but a few examples. The British attitude toward those of the quote-unquote inferior race survived well into the 20th century, and there's no better example of this than England's civilizing mission in Kenya. So again, Dennis, we go back to this, that John Stuart Mill considered actually not only to be something which was not only the English against the Irish, but it was the side of liberalism against the side of the Catholic faith, and the Pope as the head of the Catholic faith. So it became something more of as a philosophy versus faith-based situation, which probably was just like adding more fuel to the fire for England's contemptuous look upon their probably a group of people called the Irish, or probably closer to their cousins than the majority of other peoples that are on the face of the earth.
Yes. Well, what happened was you even mentioned at the beginning the Corn Laws. Sounds innocuous, simple. Sounds like a minor farming problem. Well, this was designed a couple of decades before it happened to make sure everything was in place. The English planned it all that way. And during the height of this, they were exporting a huge amount of food, yet no, they didn't allow any food to come into Ireland, and they made sure that they couldn't do much farming there, even if there was a blight. So they kept it all like on a civilized level. But you just mentioned they introduced politics as another rationalization. So they treated the Pope and other people who used love of God, truly love of God, to show that they were really interfering in humanism. So they rationalized that if you pushed the religious side too much, you would upset our beautiful economic plan, our wonderful governments we were establishing, and the financial world would now be safe because we have minimized those problems. So even though they, from a civil viewpoint, a civilized viewpoint, said minimize, they meant destroy, but they weren't using those words. So even the intellectuals in those days cited where all the money was going, and therefore the world seemed to be happy.
What a situation this. I mean,
it was a mess. And even today, to explain it, it's very hard because the English threw the kitchen sink into the whole situation and blamed the Irish for causing it.
Well, one more thing that the Messiah is going to have to intervene on to sit down and arbitrate between these two peoples. Again, as I mentioned just a moment ago, we're probably closer in terms of their lineage, tracing back to the children of Noah who came out of the ark, than most other peoples on the earth. But that's all I have to say on that. I just want to cover a little bit more ground, Dennis, before we conclude the show, because this matter is so deep. But we want to just mention how the British also pushed their humanistic ideas onto the continent of Africa. We're going to read down to the bottom of the page today. And, of course, I'll be looking forward to your comment on this. During the late 19th century, the British pushed the indigenous peoples, mainly the Kikuyu, off of the land that they lived for centuries. And by World War II, over 30,000 British, quote-unquote, settlers were living off the fat of the Kenyan land, producing cash crops such as coffee and tea. The Kenyan colony became even more important when India threw off the British imperial yoke and Kenya became the new jewel in the rapidly tarnishing British crown. You know, they say that the sun never set on the British Empire. Well, it was rapidly setting at that point after World War II. Of course, the ungrateful Kikuyu, you can just imagine that when Alan wrote that, he wrote that, the ungrateful Kikuyu were becoming disgruntled about being the recipients of Mill's greatest happiness principle, which has, of course, meant the greatest happiness for the white British who had taken the best arable land and had resettled the Kikuyu into reserves or reservations, much as the Americans forced the Native Americans onto reservations during the 19th century. As conditions in the reserves deteriorated because of overcrowding, the Kikuyu anger reached critical mass, turning into an armed rebellion known as the Mau Mau War. The worldwide press at the time was wholly sympathetic to the brave British settlers who were defending themselves against the onslaught of the brutal and savage Mau Mau. It was many decades later when a much different picture began to develop, mainly due to the work of Harvard professor Carolyn Elkins. Elkins spent many years in Africa interviewing the Kikuyu and trying to uncover the truth about the Mau Mau War and in its aftermath. The attitude of the British towards the Kikuyu was not only based on religious attitudes, but on the enlightened views of reason and science. The whites, particularly Englishmen, were physically and intellectually superior to the non-whites, and that to profit by Africans, it seemed that whites must subvert them. On entering Kenya, therefore, settlers also entered a 19th century South African debate on how to construct political security and morality on shifting sands. It was never resolved whether in white opinion or in the priorities of the colonial state. Of course, conservatives thought Africans inherently primitive. Liberals thought that they were like retarded children who promised well as modern men. And that was quoting from John Lansdale, Mau Maus of the Mind, Making Mau Mau and the Remaking of Kenya, the Journal of African History, Volume 31, Number 3, published in 1990, page 401. So Dennis, again, here we see this cultural ethnocentrism based on not just the color of one's skin, but the idea of reasoning and science, while they were brutally undermining the sovereignty of the native people of the Kenyan country.
Well, back then and today, Don, a lot of people are pushing humanism, but to me it doesn't make sense because they don't include life. They say humanism comes first. Well, they don't say it, they imply it, that humanism comes first above all else, while we go back to what is life and the value of life. We place our hope, faith, and belief in the Creator who created life for us, not humanism. But then again, if people want to supersede everything else by talking about humanism, and they call it liberalism, or if they want to call it this, that, or anything else, and they believe that the people who think about this are the superior ones, and if you're not doing it, you're inferior. So
right.
How can you say you're interested in humans and you don't emphasize life?
So, Dennis, with that being said, we've just run out of time, and we're going to segue out of our program. I'd like to thank you again for taking one of your most valuable resources, your precious time, to share this past almost half hour with me. And before we sign off with our segue and the music, David Doman, by the way, we want to mention a prayer and a blessing for complete healing for his wife, Kyla Ben-Chana, who is just at the beginning process of undergoing chemotherapy. May Kyla, daughter of Chana, have a complete healing, and may it come from testimony from those who see that it's not a contradiction to use human intervention with the blessings of the Almighty Creator. So, Dennis, what can you give for our blessed listening audience as a nugget of wisdom to chew on for the rest of the day?
Chew on that your conscience is probably the best thing you have, because if you're listening to the news, reading newspapers, a lot of truth is not in that. It's opinion, and it's trying to cover up certain amount of things. Not that I'm paranoid or anything like that. Some of your own personal ideas are not that bad if they're based on faith and belief.
Thank you, Dennis. And so now we're going to turn to Dennis Dolmar, our blessed brother out in jolly old England, the place of John Stuart Mill. But David Dome is a man who believes in the Creator, has faith in the Creator, and makes music to remind us that we are perfectly imperfect. That's the name of the song we'll be playing today. We've played it before. We'll probably play it many times in the future with the blessings of the Most High. And I just remind you, everyone listening, or we'll be hearing this on the archive version, you have got to be good. Why do you have to be good? Because Atev Tov Lehetiv, it's the nature of the good to do good. The Creator is the source of all goodness. And implanted in your unique human DNA, your unique divine image, which will help you get up in scrimmage to realize your Tzelem Elohim is no dream, and all this should be accomplished in the way of a Havachad, one love, Goral Echad, one destiny, Kolano for all of us, Bardarchi Noam, in a pleasant way, Darchi Shom, in a peaceful way. And even though you might feel that little ambivalence, that's okay, bless souls. Listen to the words of David Dome, perfectly imperfect, to realize it's okay to be perfectly imperfect, because that way we are vessels to realizing there is one who is beyond all measurement of perfection or imperfection, because the Creator is the source of everything, including the source of our life. So let's give thanks and praise to the Creator and try to help others as we make it through our day. Take care, everyone.
Best way to go. Why people would choose to hate, I will never know. A childhood trauma made a mark that will not go. If you pretend you do not have it, it might just always show. And nobody is perfect. Why feign to be? Perfectly imperfect brings the best out in me. Doesn't mean I don't stop fighting, but I conquer them all. The truth will keep me standing, and pride comes before a fall. Perfect imperfection, give me something I can use. On the path to enlightenment, it's a constant use. I'm connecting to the fact I can't stand. up to win the war. Turn these demons into angels. What else is love for? There's no point in holding grudges. They only kill the soul. In the end, they're only kindness. Kindness is my goal.
I can't stand.